Thank you, Father Aquinas. This is really a privilege for me to finally come to the Dominican House of Studies. I'm a lay Dominican, but I've actually never been here, so I'm very happy to be with you. All right, so the title of my paper is Neuroscience and the Human Soul. And you doubtlessly know what neuroscience is, namely that it's the part of biology that studies the nervous system. The branches of neuroscience that are concerned with understanding the brain and its relationship to cognition and emotion are the ones that have the most direct bearing on the question of whether humans have souls. As for understanding what the human soul is, the Thomistic tradition maintains that one must first talk about what the soul in general is, and then what is distinctive about the human soul, namely that it's the cause of the life activities of thinking abstractly and freely choosing. Many of those that think that the findings of neuroscience challenge the notion that humans have souls do not make these distinctions. For example, they often conflate soul and mind. Since what these people propose in many cases has more immediate bearing on the faculties of the human soul, intellect, and free will, than on the soul itself, I will begin by looking at these faculties and later we'll talk about the soul. When it comes to the intellect, some claim that neuroscience shows that our thoughts have physical causes, and so they maintain that scientists are able to read people's minds by identifying the physical causes in question. When it comes to free will, certain experiments done by neuroscientists appear to show that our free choices are determined by our brains and that free will is an illusion. I will elaborate further on these claims, but I'm going to begin by explaining why the Thomistic tradition maintains that the intellect is immaterial, from which it follows that neuroscience can say nothing about the intellect as such. There's any number of different meanings of the word intelligence. An animal that can learn is in some sense intelligent. But the word intellect generally names a very specific form of intelligence, one that is different from the sensory knowledge that makes animals capable of learning. How exactly does intellectual knowledge differ from sense knowledge? The intellect is capable of grasping universal truths, such as physical and chemical laws, various philosophical truths, and very simple truths, basic principles such as the whole is greater than the part, and equals added to equals give equals. In order to understand these truths, we must first form the individual concepts involved, whole, part, greater, and so forth. A number of thinkers maintain that there's no difference between a concept or abstract thought and a sense perception. However, the senses only know particular things. I see and smell this rose, not rose in general. Imagination is a type of sensibility as it too apprehends the particular. I imagine a specific rose, not rose in general. The intellect forms the concept rose, which it understands to belong to every particular rose that is, was, and ever will be. Now, many thinkers confuse the intellect with the imagination, but it's not hard to see that the two are not the same thing. So right now, everyone think of a dog. When I ask you to think of a dog, you do two things. You picture a particular dog, and you bring to mind the concept dog, and you know that these two things are not the same. So for example, when I said think of a dog, maybe you imagined a German Shepherd, which is a rather large dog. But if I asked you, is a Chihuahua a dog? You'd say, yes, of course. Well, what does that show? It shows that the image you formed initially of a dog is not the same as the concept dog. And the difference between the universal and the particular is reflected in the ways we speak. You can't say that this dog is that dog, but you can say of every single dog that it's a dog. The concept dog abstracts from the features that make a particular dog the particular dog that it is. A further truth is that concepts are not physical things. All physical things have some quantitative dimension. So go back to the example of think of a dog. The dog that you imagine has a size in your imagination. You can imagine a bigger or smaller dog next to the dog you initially imagined. Now, in reality, a dog that's 3 feet high is taller than a dog that's 1 foot high, and the image of a 3 foot high dog is greater in height than the image of a 1 foot high dog. But the concept 3 feet is not a bigger concept than the concept 1 foot. It's a concept of a bigger length, but it itself has no size. If the concept had a size, it would be an image of sorts and would not be applicable to everything that had a dimension of 3 feet. If we form and consider ideas with our intellect, the intellect cannot be an ability belonging to a merely physical thing. Physical things act upon other physical things, either imparting new properties to them, such as warmth or motion, or causing them to be transformed into another substance, as when a spark turns oxygen and hydrogen into water. But a physical thing can't act on a physical thing and turn it into a non-physical thing. There's always some underlying matter involved in physical changes that persist throughout the change. So neither the brain nor any body part can produce an idea. This shows that the intellect must be immaterial. A complementary argument for the immateriality of the intellect stems from considering the way in less general concepts fall under a more general concept. In the Platonic dialogue, the Parmenides, it's suggested that the general concept is like a tent, which covers a number of different things. So, for example, the concept animal would cover the concepts of dog and pig and frog and so forth. The problem with this view is that only part of the tent covers each thing under the tent. Yet the whole concept animal applies to the concepts of dog and pig and frog. Everything that is true of animal is true of dog. Everything that is true of animal is true of pig, and so forth, and not just part of what's true of animal. So the extension the concept animal has cannot be some type of physical extension, in which case the intellect which forms the concepts also cannot be a physical thing. Now, one thing that confuses a lot of people is it seems that if thinking abstract thoughts is a non-physical activity, then it could not be affected by damage to a physical organ, namely the brain. And strictly speaking, this is true. However, as Aristotle points out, thinking depends on imagining. Now, just as cooking dinner depends on having obtained food to cook, but those are two different activities, so too, thinking depends on imagining, and imagination is an activity that's carried on using the brain. Just as I can't cook if I have no food, the intellect cannot think without an appropriate image produced by the imagination. Why is that? Well, we can't form a concept of a tree or cat without first sensing those things. If what we perceive leaves no lasting impression, we're not going to be able to form a thought about it. If someone asked a person, "What did you see?" and the person said, "I don't know, I don't remember, the person is not going to have thoughts about that thing. So what we sense needs to be retained in our imagination if we're going to be able to form a concept. Even once we form concepts, when thinking those thoughts, there's still a need to do so in conjunction with imagining. Why? Well, the natures of material things exist in particular individuals. Thus, we cannot completely and truly conceive the natures of these things without reference to a particular individual, and particulars are apprehended by sense and imagination. And so when we want to understand in a clear way what some abstract statement means, we spontaneously relate it back to what's concrete and imaginable. So for example, the statement, "as a thing is, so it acts," comes into sharp focus when we imagine something, for example, a sharp knife cutting nice, neat tomato slices, whereas a dull knife does not. And the organ of the imagination is part or parts of the brain. So again, thinking thoughts is an immaterial activity, but it depends on an activity exercised using the brain, namely imagining. That is why, if the parts of the brain required for imagining are affected, thinking thoughts is also affected. Now, one might object that many times we do not picture anything in particular when we think. Most of the time when we think, what we imagine are words. We all have a mental verbal stream. It still remains the case, however, that if we are to truly and completely understand a material thing, we have to relate it back to something concrete and imaginable. Otherwise, whatever words might be in our mind are finally just words. They would lack a connection with reality. Most of the time, we are habitually capable of imagining an appropriate image and simply do not bother to do so. Yet, even in those cases, imagination seems important to the extent that we imagine words. It is possible to think without words. This can be seen from the fact that sometimes we think something and cannot remember its name. Words do, however, help us remember our thoughts. If I ask myself what motion is, the words of Aristotle's definition pop up in my mind, seemingly even before I think about exactly what those words mean. It has become second nature for us to think in terms of words, and consequently it's irksome when we can't find the word we're looking for. So it seems that if the part or parts of our brain that have to do with language were damaged, that this would at least initially impede thinking, until such time as we became habituated to thinking without words. There are all kinds of fascinating studies done by neuroscientists that involve, quote-unquote, reading people's minds. What's really happening, however, is that scientists are correlating what these people are perceiving or imagining with their brain activity, and then using the correlation to translate brain activity into what people are likely to be perceiving or imagining. For example, scientists have found a way to identify by looking at brain activity which picture among 1,000 pictures an individual happens to be looking at. The author of the study, Jack Gallant, presented data that went even further, actually reconstructing what volunteers were seeing from their visual cortex activity as they viewed a series of movie trailers. For instance, the program would spit out an outline of a white torso just when a man in a white shirt was shown the subject. And T. Horikawa has even been able to tell some of the contents of people's dreams from brain scans, verified by waking them. I used to worry that the devil could read my mind. Now I have to worry about people reading it. So what is being decoded in this case is what people are imagining. So another type of mind reading has to do with reading people's intentions. So in a study done by Evers and Sigmund, subjects were given the choice between two tasks to perform, adding or subtracting two numbers, and asked to hold on to their intention during a variable period of delay during which MRI measurements were taken. Measurements of activity in the prefrontal cortex were found to predict with 71% accuracy which operation was intended. However, it's not really surprising that this can be done. When we intend to do something, it's always something specific. We can't add or subtract in general, but we perform this or that act of adding or subtracting. And our intention to add or subtract necessarily involves an image, and forming an image involves the brain, and brain activity is something that an MRI can monitor. Thus, for those who belong to the Thomistic tradition, we regard these feats with admiration, but not with consternation. Scientists and philosophers involved in this type of research will talk about, quote-unquote, reading thoughts from brain activity, and make claims such as, and I quote, "We've shown that with the right technology, these people's thoughts could be decoded and understood by any listener," end quote. Thomas recognized that the word thought is sometimes loosely used to mean image in the imagination, rather than an abstract thought is produced or considered by the intellect. Again, when we think of a dog, we actually perform two mental processes. We picture a dog, and we bring to mind the concept dog. People often do not distinguish these two activities, and consequently use the word thought as though an image and a concept were the same thing. The word mind also has more than one meaning. Mind can refer to the intellect or to the imagination or to both together. If one takes mind to mean intellect, the brain is not the organ of the mind, for the intellect has no organ. If one takes mind to mean imagination, then the brain or parts thereof is the organ of the mind. There's plenty of evidence that higher animals have minds while lacking intellect. It's not wrong to speak of an animal mind or to speak of imagination as a mental function. Much of the supposed threat of neuroscience to the notion that the intellect is immaterial comes from the failure to understand the difference between the intellect and the imagination. Now, maybe at a certain point, neuroscientists will be able to decode our mental verbal stream, our internal verbal monologue, and currently quite a bit of research is being done on this. Just to give one example, Nima Masgarami and his team had epilepsy patients who were already undergoing brain surgery listen to sentences spoken by different people, and the scientists recorded their brain activity. The neural patterns recorded were used to train a decoder that can translate brain activity into intelligible speech. The researchers then asked the patients to listen to speakers reciting numbers between 0 and 9 and recorded the brain signals. The brain signals were then run through the decoder. The sound produced by the decoder in response to those signals was analyzed and cleaned up by a type of artificial intelligence that mimics the structure of brain cells. The end result was a robotic-sounding voice reciting a sequence of numbers with about 75% accuracy. So researchers were able to know what a person was hearing, starting from their brain waves. Researchers in the Knight Laboratory seem even closer to decoding our mental verbal stream. They have developed a way to decode some of the words of subjects who are silently reading. But even if scientists succeeded in decoding our mental verbal stream, words signify thoughts, but are not thoughts. So strictly speaking, they would not be reading the thoughts that we're thinking, but would infer our thoughts by detecting the physiological activities required for us to imagine words. Even when you hear people say something, you can't be entirely sure what they're understanding by their own words. If perceiving language was the same as perceiving thoughts, then we could not misunderstand what others mean, aside from when we don't hear them properly. I remember one case where a student came up to me all excited that she had understood the statement I made, and then she explained it completely wrong. Okay, so obviously the words meant one thing to her and another thing to me, and this happens, you know, with a certain frequency. All right, so if we got to the point where we could decipher minimally conscious persons' verbal mental streams, we would not be perceiving their thoughts, but rather would be inferring from the neurophysical activities required to imagine specific words what words they're using to express their thoughts. Another thing to note, which I'll come back to when I talk about the soul, is that the scientists are not accessing the individual's conscious experiences, but only the neural correlates thereof. They could not know that the neural activity corresponded to the imagining of a word unless the subject told them so. We've seen so far that the claim that neuroscience poses a challenge to traditional ideas regarding the non-material component of the human mind is unfounded. What we've seen is that neuroscience can pick out the brain activity that correlates with sensing and imagining things, but not with thinking abstractly. Again, a common reason why people think that there's some kind of conflict between neuroscience and the notion that the intellect is immaterial is due to their failure to reflect upon the difference between thinking and imagining and the manner in which the former depends on the latter. All right, so now I'm going to turn to free will. We all have a direct experience of having free will. For example, I know that I did not have to accept the invitation to speak here today, and you know that you didn't have to choose to attend this talk. Some will claim in the name of neuroscience that the seeming knowledge we have that we don't have to choose what we choose is illusory. Benjamin Libet's experiments in the 1980s are often cited as having shown that free will is an illusion. In these experiments, the participants were asked to flex their wrist whenever they felt like it and then report the moment they became conscious of their intention to do so, which they kept track of by observing a modified clock where a revolving hand moved faster than normal clock hands. We would expect that we first have a conscious awareness of an intention to act, which activates the motor area of our brain, which results in what's called a readiness potential, which then sends a signal to our wrist, and then we flex our wrist. That's what we would figure would be the sequence of events, okay? What as a matter of fact happened is that the participants' readiness potential spiked 550 milliseconds before the actual motion, but the participants' reports of their intention to move precede the motion by only 200 milliseconds. Conscious awareness of a desire to flex the wrist arose only after the brain got ready to send signals to the muscles. So it seems that our brain makes up our minds for us, and we only become consciously aware of our quote-unquote decision after the fact. Based on this experiment and other similar experiments, some people concluded that free will does not play a role in our decisions. Philosopher Andrew Mealy rejects this interpretation of Libet's experiments on the grounds that this test involves an arbitrary action where nothing is at stake, and there is no reason to perform the action at one time rather than another. Mealy compares it to being in a grocery store and picking out one jar of peanut butter rather than other light jars that are sitting next to it. Picking this one or that one makes no difference. Whereas in cases when we're clearly exercising free choice, what college to go to, whether to marry this person, something is at stake, and it does matter which individual we choose. Even in more everyday choices, such as should I do the dishes or leave them for others to do, or should I attend this lecture, your choices have consequences. But again, it's inconsequential whether we pick the jar on the right or the left. So Libet's experiments involving flexing one's wrist really sheds no light on free will. Father Anselm Ramelow, who spoke yesterday, gives another argument against the view that Libet's experiments show that we don't have free will. Father Ramelow's position is that it was at the time that the subjects agreed to follow the directions given them that they made the free choice. They freely agreed at the start of the experiment to flex their wrist within 30 seconds once they felt an urge to do so. When they flexed their wrist in specific instances, they weren't making a new choice, but simply executing their original choice. So similarly, if I ask one of my colleagues, or I tell one of my colleagues, I'll meet you at the faculty club for lunch at noon, I don't make a separate choice when it gets close to noon and I get up and I start walking there. Okay? Simply executing the choice I originally made. Okay, unless something comes up to make me rethink my decision, okay, then I might have to choose again. But ordinarily, we make a decision, we execute it, we're on autopilot. All right, so even if we set aside Mealy's and Ramelow's arguments that show that Libet's experiments do not bear on free choice, there would still remain a way of interpreting Libet's experiment in a way that's compatible with free will. Libet's experiments also show that people can choose to override the urge to flex. Their conscious decision to not flex after all, in response to the urge, precedes a flattening of the readiness potential that had been activated. Consequently, some concluded that our free will takes the form of free won't. Looked at this way, Libet's experiments don't reveal anything other than what ordinary experience tells us. We often have spontaneous inclinations to do certain things, but we can override them. For example, the smell of coffee outside a coffee shop triggers the desire for a cup of coffee, but we don't have to act on that desire. And sometimes, for no reason known to ourselves, we feel like doing something and may even take steps towards doing it, but we can still override it and decide to stay on task. I'm always finding myself walking downstairs to the kitchen and like, where am I going? All right, so our senses, including the internal senses, such as memory and imagination, provoke various emotions without us choosing to feel these emotions. But what we do in response to these emotions is a matter of choice. So even if we were not to entirely reject Libet's experiments as having no bearing on free will, as Mealy and Ramelow do, here is yet another way to understand them, one that doesn't rule out free will. An urge for something specific arises, and then we become aware of it, but that doesn't determine our choice because we can always resist the urge at that point. Aquinas, by the way, thinks that many people largely follow their feelings. In one particularly pessimistic passage, Aquinas does not reject Aristotle's statement that the bad is found in many and the good in few, but takes it to mean that many people pursue sensible goods as being better known to them, forsaking the good of reason, which is known to few. So in other words, Aquinas is basically saying, most people just go with the flow. Whatever they feel like doing, they just kind of do. They don't really use reason to examine their emotions and their actions. All right. There are other experiments in the same line as Libet's that I'm not going to go into, because I believe Father Ramelow talked about them. In any case, the same sort of critique that can be given of Libet's experiments apply to them as well. So, for example, in one experiment, at a tone, you were supposed to either look to the right or to the left, okay? But that's like the peanut butter case. It really has no consequence whether you look to the right or the left. All right. So if our everyday experience of making free choices has not been eliminated by neuroscience, what reason is there to think that free will is an immaterial faculty? If it was a faculty that used an organ, then its operation would be determined by physical causes. For example, I see blue because that is the light which is not absorbed by the surface I'm looking at, but that's the light which reflects off the surface and impinges my eye. I'm not free to see another color. Now, some think that they can save free will while maintaining that it's a physical ability by recourse to quantum mechanics. This is a very popular strategy that somehow quantum mechanics is going to allow us to be free. Quantum indeterminacy, as I'm sure you know, can be illustrated by the notion of the half-life of a radioactive material. A half-life is the time it takes for half of the nuclei in a given radioactive isotope to decay. The half-life has a determinate value. However, what can't be predicted is which individual nucleus will disintegrate during that period. Even if we agree that the indeterminacy is inherent in nature and is not simply a matter of our ignorance, this is not going to provide an opening for free will. Why? Well, it doesn't matter if our decision is caused by determinate causes or indeterminate ones, such as random quantum events taking place in our brain. So long as our decision is not caused by ourselves, we're not free. The only way we can be capable of making free decisions is if part of us is immaterial. For only what is immaterial can escape the action of physical causes. Now, people object to this conclusion saying it seems to make our freedom turn on the possession of an ability to defy natural laws, an ability that's hard to explain convincingly, and even harder to show that we have. This objection is based on a materialist assumption. It assumes that everything that happens in the world is the result of physical causes acting according to natural laws. Is my thinking that this view is false, a product of physical causes acting on my brain according to natural laws? No, I reject this view on the basis of reasons, namely those given earlier concerning the immateriality of abstract thought. Indeed, the very fact that we can argue about free will shows that thought transcends the material world. Brains are not convinced by reasons. They are simply in one physical state or another due to the physical causes acting on them. If there are reasons to reject materialism, the conclusion that follows from it, that free will cannot transcend physical causality, is unwarranted. All right. So in this first part of the talk, I've been focusing on the faculties of intellect and free will. Now I'm going to start talking about the soul. So basically, I'm going to talk about what the soul is in general, and then I'm going to talk about what is specific to the human soul. Because if you don't understand what the soul is in general, then you're not going to properly understand the supposed attacks of neuroscience on the human soul. So the initial philosophical notion of the soul arises from observing that some things are alive and other things are not. Living things move themselves, and non-living things do not. Living things thus must have something about them that causes them to differ from non-living ones. That is what the soul is. According to this view, a live pine tree has a soul, as does a cat. So the soul is first understood as simply the cause of a being's ability to carry on life activities. So again, this is just very rock bottom. We observe some things move on their own, other things don't. There has to be a cause. Okay? And we posit the soul as being that cause. So what is it, though? Well, in antiquity, certain thinkers maintained that the soul is a harmony, or in other words, that it's simply the complex interactive order of the living thing's parts. and there are philosophers and scientists nowadays who defend this position. According to them, the cat's soul is understood to be the respiratory system of the cat interacting with the cardiovascular system, interacting with the nervous system, and so forth. Death is explained solely by the breakdown of essential interactions among these systems. One variant of this view sees the soul to be the totality of ordered interactions at the level of the molecules composing the living thing. And neurobiologist William Newsom suggests that the soul is the unique pattern of relationships embedded in the neural connections in the brain. Aristotle and Aquinas reject that understanding of the soul. Aquinas explains why in his commentary on Aristotle's De Anima, and I quote, "For the soul cannot be said to be a harmony, according as harmony is found in composite things and things having composition. For the order of the composite parts in the body is quite apparent. For it's easy to know the order of bones to bones, and of nerves to nerves, and of arm to the hand, and of flesh to bones. But the relation of the order of the parts of the soul is not apparent to us. For we're not able to know through the order of the bodily parts the order that exists among the intellect and the sense and the appetite and things of this sort," end quote. Indeed, not only does studying the body alone tell us nothing about the relationship of sensation, imagination, emotion, and intellect to each other, but it also does not give us the knowledge that's crucial for understanding even one of these faculties. As physicist Erwin Schrödinger notes, and I quote, "We may be sure that there's no nervous process whose objective description includes the characteristic yellow color or sweet taste, just as little as the objective description of an electromagnetic wave includes either of these characteristics," end quote. We would not know that we are tracing physical changes involved in vision if we did not first have the experience of seeing. The experience of seeing cannot be reduced to a series of physical changes among interacting parts. To see is to be aware of color, if only color on a grayscale. None of the physical parts involved in the visual system have the property of being aware. Neurons lack awareness, the proteins that make them up lack awareness, the amino acids that make up the proteins lack awareness, and so forth. Now, some will claim that if enough physical parts interact in certain ways, awareness will emerge. They will point to properties such as fluidity, which a single water molecule does not have, but which many together have, or to surface tension, which again, a single water molecule does not have, but many together have. These properties, however, are partially contained in the individual molecules. To give a comparison, a human being cannot surround another person, but can be part of a group of human beings that do so because each human can partially surround someone. A human being might not be able to lift a heavy object, but with another person is able to because each of them are capable of lifting some weight. Similarly, each water molecule has the ability to move, and flowing is a type of motion, and each water molecule has part of the ability to produce surface tension because each is a dipole. In the case of collective properties, nothing of a different kind emerges. We see this in artifacts. No one part of an inkjet printer can print, but one part can move another part that moves the ink onto the paper. So there's really nothing new in the case of collective properties. And by new, I mean something different in kind. Like, take another example, a bicycle. If you have a bicycle pedal, that's not going to transport a person. But a bicycle pedal is capable of sustaining weight, and it's capable of motion. And that's what the whole bicycle does. It sustains weight and allows the person to move. So there's really nothing new there, okay? Even though it's true, the pedal itself wouldn't allow for the locomotion of a person. Sense knowledge, however, is different in kind from the physical motions that are required for it to occur. One can see this by asking how one could best explain sight to a person who is blind from birth. So approach one would be to explain the physiology of the visual system in all its scientific detail. Approach two would be to say to the blind person, sight is similar to hearing and smelling. You're aware of sounds, and you're aware of odors, and so you realize that awareness can be of different things. Well, there's this other sensible thing called color, and sight is awareness of it. Now, of course, the blind person will not then know exactly what it means to see, but still gets a better idea of what sight is when it's explained in terms of the subjective experience of sensing than when it's explained in terms of physical interactions. The same point can also be made in regard to emotion. Certain physiological changes take place when we feel different emotions. These changes are not about something, but ordinarily feelings are about something. If I asked you, why are you afraid? And you told me that your adrenal medulla has released epinephrine and this is causing your heart to beat faster, I would not be satisfied. Brain activities and other physiological activities simply are. They're not about something. No scientist could identify that a person was angry by monitoring physiological changes in the body if he or she did not first know from internal experience that anger is a desire to get even. The desire to get even can be correlated with the physiological changes, but it's not reducible to them. For Aristotle and Aquinas, the inability to fully explain sense perception and emotion in terms of the interaction of physical parts is a reason to hold that the soul of a living thing is not the totality of the living thing's physical parts and their coordinated interactions. All right, so Aristotle and Aquinas reject views that would reduce the soul to the harmony of the organism's parts. So what do they hold the soul is? Well, here we need to try to understand the difficult notion of substantial form. I'll do the best I can to explain the notions of substantial change and substantial form, but don't be surprised if they don't immediately make sense to you. These notions need to be repeatedly considered, and especially in contrast to their alternatives. But we have to begin somewhere, right? One of the things I want to bring out is that nothing I've said commits me to the Cartesian view that we're composed of two substances, an immaterial substance, the soul, and a second substance, a physical body. I'll briefly sketch out the Aristotelian hylomorphic, literally matter-form, alternative, which is sometimes labeled dualism, but it's a very different sort of dualism than that of Descartes. If I have in my hand a piece of blackboard chalk, I have in my hand both a cylinder and calcium carbonate, but I do not have two things in my hand. The cylindrical form is not separate from the calcium carbonate whose form it is. Form is not matter, but the two together make up one thing. Now, the notion of substantial form is arrived at by Aristotle through an analysis of different kinds of changes. When I get a tan or a pot belly, I remain a human being. These changes are referred to as accidental changes. An accident is something that exists in another as in a subject. So my skin color is an accident, and the same for my girth. However, when I die, I'll turn into a bunch of chemicals. That is a substantial change. Aristotle goes on to draw a parallel between accidental changes and substantial changes. He says, just as going from being flat-stomached to being pot-bellied supposes an underlying subject, so too a change from being one substance to being another must suppose something that underlies the change. And he calls this prime matter. Prime matter is the ability a substance has to become another substance. It accounts for continuity in change. When a squirrel dies, it's not as if, poof, a number of chemicals suddenly come to exist where a living body was before. Just as a subject that has undergone an accidental change acquires a new accidental form, so too does prime matter that undergoes a substantial change acquire a new substantial form. A substantial form makes a thing to be one individual thing possessing a certain nature. Non-living natural things have substantial forms that make them to be one substance rather than another, and they have prime matter, that is, the capacity to be changed into another substance. Oxygen, for example, seems to be a substance. It has the capacity to be transformed into another substance by means of a nuclear reaction. In addition to this capacity for change, it has a substantial form that makes it oxygen and not something else. So a plant, a worm, a cat, and so forth, like oxygen and nitrogen, each have a substantial form that make them to be the particular kind of substance they are, and they have prime matter, that is, an underlying capacity to be changed into another substance. Why talk about living things having a particular kind of substantial form, namely the soul? This goes back to what I was saying earlier. It's because living things manifest activities that go beyond those that non-living natural things are capable of performing. In other words, we don't think that the fact that a dog, when dropped, falls downwards, requires us to posit a soul. It's rather because the dog has feelings, its senses, and so forth. And sensing is not reducible to the interaction of a group of physical parts, all of which lack awareness. The dog's soul makes the dog to be a substance of a specific sort that's capable of carrying on activities which go beyond what non-living natural things are capable of, be it individually or collectively. Now, I've heard a person who claims to work in the Thomistic tradition to maintain that the soul is not posited to explain sensing, feeling, emotion, and so forth, but only to explain why the body decays. There are two reasons to reject this view. First, all natural bodies, living and non-living, are subject to corruption. We don't maintain that oxygen has a soul because it can be transformed into another element. It's only because we know that we and other living things are different from non-living things because we sense, we have emotions, and so forth, that we posit there's such a thing as a soul. Secondly, action follows being. If a sighted animal is one living thing because of its soul, then its life activities will depend on its having a soul rather than on causes independent from its soul. To say that a cat is a cat because it has a cat soul, but it does cat-like things such as see because of a set of physical causes independent of the soul, dissociates action from being, what the cat does, from what the cat is. The cat's eyes would not be cat's eyes without the soul, and so they wouldn't be functional. It is the cat's substantial form that makes the cells in its eyes, along with certain cells in its brain, capable of being an instrument of sight in the cat, allowing the cat to be aware of color. In the case of humans, not only is the reason to say that cats have a soul applicable, for we too sense and have emotions and so forth, but there is reason to say that our soul is of a different kind than that of the cat because we, in addition, have the ability to think and choose. In both cases, the soul is not something separate from the body, but what makes the body to be a living body of a specific kind, feline and human. Again, the relationship is similar to the calcium carbonate and cylindrical shape of a piece of chalk not being separate entities. The soul is the substantial form that makes prime matter to exist as a specific kind of being. There is a further difference between the human soul and the cat soul. Namely, the human soul is separable. That is, it remains in existence after death because it's an immaterial thing. But on the Aristotelian Thomistic view, it's not the whole human individual. You're only partly there. More important part, though. So much for this very brief account of the Thomistic understanding of the soul. I hope that this sketch makes it clear that nothing I've said in the earlier part of the talk about the immateriality of the intellect and free will need be construed as an endorsement of Cartesian dualism, which makes human beings into two separate substances. The human soul in a living person is the substantial form of a living body and not separate from it. It, however, unlike an animal soul, is capable of existing separated from the body. So in conclusion, neuroscience-based arguments against the soul do not face up to the evidence that life activities such as sensation cannot be accounted for solely in terms of material parts and their interactions. Neuroscience-based arguments against specifically the human soul are generally directed at giving a materialist account of the life activities of choosing and thinking abstractly. As we've seen, arguments that are based on Libet's and other similar experiments fail to eliminate free choice. And as we've seen, if free choice exists, it must be an immaterial faculty, in which case neuroscience has nothing to say about it as such. Similarly, we have seen that the mind reading neuroscientists currently are and predictably will be capable of in the future does not involve observing abstract thoughts, but rather detecting neural correlates of images, including those for words. If the reflections on what we do when we think articulated above are correct, ideas are immaterial, and so we must conclude that the findings of neuroscience cannot have any bearing on our capacity for abstract thought as such. These conclusions by no means denigrate the tremendous power neuroscience has to identify the physiological underpinnings of human activities, such as imagining, remembering, feeling emotion, knowledge that has amazing potential for developing ways of communicating with minimally conscious persons, preventing memory loss, and treating various emotional conditions such as post-traumatic stress disorder. Philosophy can't do these things. Philosophy, however, can help us reflect on our ordinary experience, which is what I've tried to do here. Thank you.
If everything you said about what the soul is true, what are the implications of if your brain dies, if you're dead, what are the faculties that remain to you according to this? Because apparently imagination comes from the brain. So if you're a disembodied spirit, you have no imagination, do you have memory? What's left?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and there's a lot of literature written by Thomas on this particular topic. You could give like a completely different lecture on it, which I'm not prepared to give today, but just to flesh out what your question is. So, all right, we have a kind of intellect that depends on imagining, but imagination is a brain function. Your brain's kaput, so what are you going to be doing, you know? So nonetheless, the ideas that you originally formed, since they're immaterial, they're not gonna go anywhere. Okay, but are you gonna be able to access them? And that's where the debate is. Okay, so I honestly, at this point, don't have a fixed view. I'm listening to both sides. But I think it's a really important question. One thing I'll just add is that another option that's offered, Aquinas suggests that disembodied souls are given angelic forms. So angels have ideas, they have abstract thoughts. Well, they're not abstract because they didn't abstract them, but they're immaterial, okay? But they allow the angel to know the particular, okay? Which is weird because our universal thoughts don't allow us to know the particular. We can only know our particular through imagination and sense and so forth. But your guardian angel knows you, okay? So the angels have knowledge of particulars without having senses. So Aquinas is saying that maybe disembodied souls are given these kind of angelic forms, but he basically says that they're like way too strong. So we get a kind of fuzzy knowledge out of them, but our minds are not really capable to fully unpack everything that's in them. But yeah, that's a great question. Like I say, you could probably have a whole conference on that, and there's a lot of literature out there. If you email me, I can send you links to a lot of different articles. Excellent question. Yes.
Hi. I have a question about, I think, the earlier part of your talk, and I might have misunderstood you, but so I have a friend of mine who has a dog, and this dog hates adult human men, right? Like, whenever I walk in, starts barking at me, and same thing goes for all her other male friends, whatever. Now, isn't that a kind of abstraction that the dog is capable of, or no?
That's a really good question. So animals, they definitely have memories, okay? And in your memory, you can store a lot of similar things, and you can then, without forming a universal, you can still recognize a thing because basically what you're doing is you're matching to the sample, okay? So you have these different, you might have an image, okay, male or whatever, but then you see this individual, and this individual looks like that male. I don't know why it started hating males or, you know, whatever the reason was. Let's say that a man kicked him, okay? So the dog has this image of the male kicking him and then sees this being, and it's like, ooh, that looks the same as this, and then has the same reaction. And you can have a bigger collection because animals definitely can match to sample, you know? So I think you can do that just using imagination and memory. Sure.
Thanks for your talk. Am I up next?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, all right, very good. So if abstraction, okay, so it seems to me that there's a cultural dimension to words that constitute our intellects. Okay, so it seems to me that in some sense, the abstraction that the intellect does is utterly dependent upon having had the experiences of our culture. In other words, that's memory, we have words for it, and then abstraction kind of comes out of that, and then it seems that there's a form of intellectual disability for people who are deaf, who are not given words, and if they're not given words, in other words, they don't learn, they have a sort of a language deprivation that leads to intellectual disability. So I'd like to hear you reflect on the intellect as immaterial and therefore can deal in the abstractions, but how, you know, you still have to have imagination in order for intellect to become what it's capable of becoming. And so I'd like to hear you reflect upon this immaterial intellect that still needs culture, imagination, in order to form in the proper way.
I don't know, you can tell me if I'm not then addressing your question, but take for example Helen Keller. Okay, so here you have someone who's, from a sensory point of view, is extremely deprived, right? Okay. What's interesting, though, is that once she got what language was, once she made that connection, she started asking questions about things. And she started asking for names of things. It's not like she had no ideas before she was given language. Okay.
Well, but she had experience of having language from a very early age and then lost it before she was able to reacquire it. So some would argue that it was by virtue of having had that prior experience that she was then capable of forming an imagination such that she could then do the abstraction. So I...
Okay, but fair enough. I think that's a totally fair point. However, there's another case documented by Susan Schaller. I forget the... Ildefonso was the name of the person. This person was deaf, and no one had taught him sign language, and he was deaf from birth. And she found him, and she eventually was able to teach him sign language. But upon teaching sign language, he started then to recount who he was. So he had all these ideas about his previous life, that he was like a migrant, that these were his parents, he came from here. He had ideas. So it's the idea that he needed to have a language to have ideas, I don't think so. Also, we would have to ask, how could you ever get words? What, people are just making sounds randomly, whoop, whoop, and then all of a sudden thoughts pop in their head? No, there's something in their head that they're deciding that they want to communicate to someone else, or they want to view as a kind of mental shorthand for their own selves. Thought has to come first, and that means abstraction has to come first. Now, these first thoughts may be very, very rudimentary. I mean, no matter what culture you're in, you have to have an adult caretaker, you die, right? So it doesn't matter whether I'm in Spain or Timbuktu, I'm going to have an adult caretaker and I'm going to have those experiences, just like an animal, okay? An animal will have those experiences. Sometimes you have more senses, sometimes you have fewer senses, in the case of Keller, in the case of Ildefonso, and so forth. So you can get experience through different senses that will feed your imagination. I mean, it's obvious that deaf people are intelligent, right? So, and vice versa, and with blind people too, they just use a different sense in order to gain what's necessary for abstraction. So I wouldn't push the cultural thing too far, because I think there's certain common things that everyone's aware of, and that's what Aquinas insists on. He says the first concept everyone forms is being. You have to know it's a thing, okay? And then you'll have other concepts that are very, very general, like a whole and part. No matter where you are, there's wholes and parts. Your whole body is a whole body, and your parts are parts. So you don't need culture for a lot of these very vague first concepts that we form. Although I agree that later on, culture is going to be a factor in how you're going to learn how to define certain concepts. Did that sort of address your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hi, thank you very much. This is very fascinating for me. I have a clarification and then a quick question. And the clarification is, you said, or I thought you said, when we think, we mostly imagine words.
Yeah, I think most of the time. Yeah, it depends on the person. So take, for example, Temple Grandin. You know who Temple Grandin is, right? Mm-hmm. Thinking in pictures. Mm-hmm. So when she hears words, she immediately puts those into pictures in her mind. She has no, you know, she can't deal with words. She wants those pictures. Mm-hmm. But right now, are you imagining a bunch of pictures when I'm talking to you? Right?
not all the time,
right.
But I would say yes, a lot of.
Okay, so
I think it's that for me. I think it might be a mnemonic, is that I, you know, associate something with something and then I remember. But
yeah,
I was curious.
Yeah, no, but it's really fascinating because some people are more on like the verbal end,
uh-huh.
and they hardly ever picture things.
Uh-huh.
In fact. To be perfectly honest, there's kind of a hole you could shoot in my paper, but I'm working on fixing it with people that have something called aphantasia. So the word aphantasia is the Greek word for imagination, basically. So if you would ask a person with aphantasia to imagine a pink elephant, they're like, I can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
They just can't do it. Now, I have some theories about that, but anyway, to get back to your question, I think it's very interesting that some people are very word-driven as far as what's going on in their imagination, and other people are very much more picture-driven.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm trying to say, though, is that if the words can't be attached back to some type of concrete reality, then the word ends up just being a word.
Okay. And then I have a quick question, actually, for the audience. And everyone who's here has thought about the soul, since that's part of what we're talking about. Does anyone have an image of their soul? I mean, just if you want to, that's. I just thought I'd throw that up. Because I do too.
I think we'll leave that for general pondering, and then we can chat about that. Yeah, actually, to give a small plug. Professor Jim Madden has spoken for the Thomistic Institute a couple of times, and he has a lecture which is on the podcast called Can You Take a Picture of Your Soul? So you might find that good kind of for back and forth as you entertain this notion. But we'll take the next question.
Thank you so much for your talk. I was wondering, when you mentioned if you look left, you can look right, and you're free to do either, neither has much consequence. It actually reminded me of that TV show Monk, where he has obsessive compulsive disorder, and he can't turn left or he can't turn right. So I was wondering, and then you briefly mentioned PTSD at the end of your talk, the role that mental illnesses can play in our decision-making and then the consequence that has on free will.
Yeah, well, I mean, definitely in certain cases, it takes away our ability to make a free choice. Okay, but in what cases, though? So, for example, it is well known that in court, a defense would be not guilty by reason of insanity. So insanity means there's some kind of mental disturbance going on such that you don't really know what you're doing. I mean, being drunk is basically the same concept, right? Then you don't freely choose. That's why guys get girls drunk. So it definitely has an impact on your free choice, what's going on with your brain and so forth. But that's where you need specialists to be able to say, you know, is this person really guilty of what they're doing, or is it due to, you know, some kind of thing like post-traumatic stress disorder and so forth. That's, I mean, another reason why we're told not to judge.
Hi. I was listening to you talking about the relationship between thinking and imagining, and I was taking some notes on the soul, but could you refresh my memory in terms of how conceptually you relate mind from the human perspective to soul and thinking and imagining?
Okay, so you're right, I didn't state that very clearly. So in virtue of having a soul, you're living a thing of a certain kind. And depending on what kind of soul you have, then you're going to have different abilities. So if you have a cat soul, you're going to be able to see and meow and have feelings, be afraid of dogs, okay? If you have a human soul, in addition, we have the ability to freely choose and to think abstractly. So those abilities come with having the soul. But our soul also allows us then to digest our food and to do any other, perform any other life activity.
Is soul different from mind?
Yes. So again, mind can mean two things. Mind sometimes means intellect, sometimes it means imagination, and sometimes it's used in kind of a blurry way to name either of them. So the soul is what's going to make a being to be a certain type of being. So a human soul is going to make a being to be a living human that has then the abilities to think and to imagine, think abstractly. So thinking abstractly is one activity of mind in the sense of intellect. Imagining is one activity of mind in the sense of imagination. Is that clear? Because that's what confuses people, because you can use mind both to mean the intellect, thinking abstractly, and you can use mind for the imagination and forming images.
Yeah, the reason I asked is because I study tracking transcendence in human narrative, and we talk about a black box of meaning making. So I'm kind of wondering, like, where meaning resides for you? Does it reside in the mind, or does it reside in thinking or imagining? How would meaning, like, where would meaning reside for you amongst those kind of constellations of concepts?
In the intellect. Yeah, the intellect is what conceives abstract truths.
Question over here. I actually just wanted to address this question right over here, to your right.
Hi.
I know, it's like pigs in space. Where's the voice?
I'm happy to be a pig in space. I just wanted to address this question about the image of a soul, because I'm actually working with Dr. Jim Madden on this exact question. We did have a one-day event on this topic at Harvard Medical School. The website for it is soulandbrain.org. It's going to be an annual series, hopefully culminating in continuing medical education curriculum. But as far as the image question, if you could, for a second, imagine stepping outside of time and looking at your own body, you wouldn't see a three-dimensional particulate object. You would see a long, continuous worm through time. And so one potential image that I would offer of the human soul is of a physical time worm that is a standing wave that has probabilistic outcomes, and that agency fits in as far as which of those probabilistic standing waves on the substrate of that human time worm ends up collapsing.
I totally don't buy that. For the reason being, if it's a physical thing, you're not going to get something like the abstraction or freely choosing. It's going to be determinate, end of story. You're going to have the quantum story, which again doesn't work. If I'm not making the choices, I'm not free. If those little quirky things going on in that wave, I'm sorry, not having it.
We have time for two more questions.
Getting back to quantum physics, sorry. I'm not sure if I'm understanding your critique of that particular out. Wouldn't the Aristotelian Thomistic tradition have to hold in order for us to be actors that there be contingency in the physical world?
For us to be able to do anything?
For us to be able to do anything. For us to be able to move our muscles to make... Otherwise, freedom means... Well, I guess I have freedom of thought, but I can't have freedom of action. I can't do just acts or courageous acts if there isn't... If morality isn't in the area of contingent, what can be other than it is. If I can't change... If I can't go into battle or not, I can choose, let's say... I want to go into battle and defend.
Well, there wouldn't be a battle.
There wouldn't be a battle, right. But doesn't that then imply that the physical world has to have some, whether it's from quantum physics or whatever, there has to be contingency in the physical world, that matter can't be predetermined in its outcome if there is to be any freedom?
Well, freedom of action, but freedom of action is not the same as freedom of choice. So I can make a free choice to go and visit my aunt, and then it turns out my car battery's dead. I can't go. But I still have the choice.
But once you discover that there's no freedom in action, then you realize there's no point in deliberating about what I'm going to do if it's predetermined.
That might be true, but that's a choice to decide that there's no point in deliberating. So even then you're making a choice. It's like, oh, there's no, what's the point now? But you might decide not to. So even then you're making a choice.
Thank you. Let me go top shelf here to Joe Brownsberg.
Thank you. I was wondering if you could expound on what you said earlier about the dog's way of concept formation and the human's way of concept formation. In what way does the human's way differ from the dog's way? And also as a brief side note, is there a point at which we know that like brain scans and things like that could not tell what's going on in the human mind or intellect or soul? Is there something that we know that sensors won't be able to detect?
Is there something that what wouldn't be able to detect? I didn't.
Like the MRIs couldn't detect about the human person. Like, is there a specific thing that?
Well, again, it couldn't know what you're thinking. It could know what words maybe, with probability, because they're only making correlations. So they could know what words that or images maybe are going on in your mind, but what the significance of those words again? They can't pin that down. But your first question was about animals. So, to my mind, the strongest test to see that that animals are not capable of abstract thought, whereas we are, is the question test, where a question is seeking knowledge for its own sake. So we obviously have the capacity for abstract thought. We're having this long conversation about neuroscience and the human soul. Human children, though, will ask questions from a very, very early age. You know, why is that dog sniffing that other dog? Why is this happening? And so forth. In fact, kids will drive you nuts at a certain age asking why. And so kids don't just ask questions to get stuff. They ask questions to understand the world. Okay? So the question, what is something, is looking for a definition. It's trying to understand what that thing is. Okay. So if a being has the ability to form thoughts, it's going to want to acquire thoughts. It's like a bird. If a bird has the ability to fly, it's going to fly. Okay? With animals, though, the animals that seem the most intelligent are obviously the great apes and the cetaceans, and then certain birds like parrots and crows. And so with the great apes, they've done these studies where they've taught them symbolic forms of communication. No transcript has ever shown is an ape asking a question simply to understand something. What the apes will use their language for is, can I have a banana? Tickle me? Can we go outside? Those are the sorts of questions they ask. And it's basically like pushing buttons, you know, like a pigeon can learn how to push buttons to get a reward. The ape knows that if it, you know, points at this token, it will get the reward being a banana. But they never use the words that they have to ask questions about the natures of things. So I think this is a very strong indication that they don't have abstract thoughts. But again, you can go a long way with just memories, because you group things together that are similar. And then when you see a new thing, if you just have a collection of memories without having an abstract thought, you're gonna match that to the things that you've seen before, and you're gonna act accordingly, as with the example I gave of the dog. But that's a really interesting question that you could probably have a whole another talk on.
Thank you.